Tonight's topic is the sixth factor of the Noble Eightfold Path, which is right effort.
Hoje à noite, o tópico é sobre o esforço correto, que é o sexto fator do caminho óctuplo.
This is the first of the factors that deal with concentration practice.
Esse é o primeiro fator que lida com a concentração correta, um fator do caminho.
The other two being right mindfulness and right concentration.
Os outros dois fatores são a mindfulness correta e a concentração correta.
And it's important to realize that these three factors work together.
É importante notar que esses três fatores, o esforço correto, a mindfulness correta e a concentração correta, eles trabalham todos juntos.
Sometimes you hear that mindfulness practice is one thing, concentration practice is something else.
Às vezes você escuta que a mindfulness correta é uma coisa e a concentração correta é outra coisa.
But the way the Buddha described these practices, they're basically one practice.
Mas da maneira em que o Buda descreve essas coisas, na verdade, elas são uma prática só, em conjunto.
Okay. And both mindfulness and concentration have to depend on right effort.
Tanto as duas, a mindfulness e a concentração, elas têm de depender no esforço correto.
Okay. I'll ask Tancelo to read the definition of right effort in Portuguese.
Então eu vou ler a definição do esforço correto. E o que, monges, é o esforço correto? 1. Em certo caso, existe um monge que gera desejo, se esforça, ativa a persistência, aplica sua mente e sustenta o seu propósito para que não surjam dhammas, malvados e inábeis que ainda não surgiram. 2. Ele gera desejo, se esforça, ativa a persistência, aplica sua mente e sustenta seu propósito para abandonar o mal e dhammas inábeis que surgiram. 3. Ele gera desejo, se esforça, ativa a persistência, aplica sua mente e sustenta o seu propósito para que surjam dhammas hábeis que ainda não surgiram. E 4. Ele gera desejo, se esforça, ativa a persistência, aplica sua mente e sustenta o seu propósito para manutenção e não confusão, aumento, plenitude, desenvolvimento, culminação de dhammas hábeis que surgiram. Isto, monges, é chamado esforço correto.
Okay, you notice that right effort is not simply brute effort.
Então, sobre o esforço correto, não é somente um esforço bruto.
It's effort that's informed by discernment.
É um esforço que é informado pelo discernimento.
And it's informed in four ways.
E ele é informado em quatro maneiras.
First is the distinction between what is skillful and unskillful.
A primeira é que a distinção entre o que é hábil e o que não é hábil.
The second is using your discernment and motivating yourself to take on these efforts.
O segundo é motivar você mesmo para agir nesses esforços.
The third is the type of effort that you exert.
O terceiro é o tipo de esforço que você aplica.
And the fourth is the amount of effort you put in.
E o quarto é a quantidade de esforço que você coloca em alguma situação.
All four of these issues require discernment.
Todas essas quatro questões, todos esses quatro problemas, elas envolvem o discernimento.
We'll take them one by one.
E vamos falar neles um por um.
First, the distinction between what is skillful and what is unskillful. This, of course, is based on mundane right effort, and also any other more subtle types of effort issues that come up. Based on mundane right view, and the subtle issues that come up as you're trying to develop skillful qualities in the mind and unskillful, and seeing them basically in terms of the thoughts that you have, where will they lead? Will they lead you to do things that are skillful, to things that are unskillful? That's how you decide whether your thoughts are skillful or not. However, when we look into the text, we find that things are not quite so clear-cut, because sometimes the Buddha will say there are things that are relatively unskillful, but you can use them in order to develop skillful qualities in the mind. For example, he gives an example of when you're angry at your enemy, and you realize, okay, if I act on my anger, I will do stupid things. Do I want to give my enemy the satisfaction of seeing me do something stupid? In this case, the motivation is not necessarily skillful. In other words, it's kind of an unfriendly attitude that you have towards your enemy. But you can use that unfriendly and sort of spiteful attitude to prevent yourself from acting on your anger. So there are cases where things that are relatively unskillful can actually lead to a skillful result. And John Lee tells the story that when he was a young monk, he would have meditation contests with his other monks. In other words, who could do sitting meditation longer, who could do walking meditation longer, who could go with less food. Now, the competitive attitude here is not necessarily skillful, but he learned through that he could sit for longer periods of time and do with less food than he might have otherwise. So it's important that you realize that in practice, sometimes things that are relatively unskillful can be used to counteract things that are even more unskillful, and that's a perfectly legitimate way of practicing. I have an example from my own practice when I was a young monk. The first time I was ordained, there was another young Thai man who was ordained at the same time, and we would go up to the top of the hill there at the monastery in Rayong and sit and meditate. And I'd be sitting there, and mosquitoes were biting me, and my legs were hurting me, and open my eyes and I'd look at him, and he looked very serene. And I kept thinking to myself, I can't, for the sake of the good name of America, I have to, I can't give up. I found out later he was just sitting there in pain when mosquitoes were biting him, and he would open his eyes and he'd see this American looking very serene. And he'd say, for the good name of Thailand, I can't give up. And that way our national pride helped us sit through the meditation. So, unskillful motivation, but it got a good result. Okay, the second way in which discernment informs right effort is with the issue of motivation, in the phrase generating desire in order to do right effort. You have to be able to talk yourself into wanting to do this. Now, you're not doing this just against your will. You try to figure out ways of talking to yourself that you are willing to engage in right effort. And the Buddha recommends various attitudes to develop in order to do this. The first one is heedfulness. The realization that if I don't train my mind, I'm going to suffer in the future. If I do train the mind, I will not suffer in the future. So I should be very careful in training the mind and trying to be as skillful as I possibly can. In fact, the Buddha said that this attitude of heedfulness is what underlies all skillful behavior. It's our motivation. It's not because we're innately good that we do skillful things, but it's because we see that there is danger in acting in unskillful ways. So that's the primary motivation that the Buddha would recommend. A few others include compassion, the realization that if I can train my mind, other people will benefit as well. If I have less greed, aversion, and delusion, other people will suffer less from my greed, aversion, and delusion. So for their sake, it's good to practice. And that can be your motivation. Another one is shame. It's a healthy shame. It's the opposite of shamelessness. You realize that there are people who would like to look good in their opinion, and if they saw that you were doing something unskillful, this would be something you'd be ashamed of. The Buddha actually recommends this. He says one of the ways that you can motivate to continue your practice, if you have unskillful thoughts in coming up in the mind, he says, you know, there are people out there in the world who can read minds. What if they were reading my mind right now? I'd feel ashamed. And so you can take that as a way of developing, of sticking with the practice. There's also the issue of pride, taking pride in the sense of you've meditated this far, you've been practicing this far, it would be a shame to stop. You actually have skills that you've developed that you should use your skills. There's also the element of joy. When you see that your unskillful qualities are falling away and that your mind is much happier as a result, and you keep reminding yourself of how good you feel when you don't give in to unskillful things. This is especially important, say, if you have an addiction. If you can succeed, say, in one night in not giving in to the addiction, then the next time you're tempted, the next morning when you wake up, remind yourself, I am so happy that I didn't give in last night. So that the next time when you feel tempted to give in to the addiction, you can remind yourself of how happy you felt when you didn't give in, and that can give you the motivation to not give in again. Finally, there's the noble example of others. This is a there's a reflection that's called sankha anusati, which is recollection of the sangha, and particularly the recollection of the people, the noble disciples of the Buddha who have behaved well in the past, who have behaved in a noble and inspiring way. There's an example given in the Ninth Canon. There was a monk who was sick out in the wilderness, and he asked himself, am I going to go back to the city to find a doctor, or am I going to stay out here and try to meditate my way through the illness? And he says one of the ways he motivated himself to stick there in the forest was to think of the inspiring example of people in the past. We read about Ajahn Mun, the other Ajahn Lee, other Ajahns who faced difficulties in the forest. We look at our own difficulties and we see they're much less than theirs. So take inspiration. Okay, if they could do this, so can I. These are various ways that you can use your discernment to motivate yourself to not just do the right effort, but also want to do the right effort. A final one that I often used to motivate myself was when I was in Thailand. There were some very poor people who would put food in my bowl. One couple in particular, they had just gotten married. They lived in a tiny little shack that was just big enough for the two of them. But every morning they would have a little piece of sausage or a little piece of dried fish or something to put in my bowl. And so when I came back from my alms round and had my meal, I would sit down and say, okay, here you are, the benefit of a poor person's generosity. You better practice. So in this case, it's a sense of duty where you realize that you've been the beneficiary of somebody's sacrifice, and so you should have some gratitude towards them. In this way, gratitude can also be a way of motivating yourself to practice. So that's another way in which discernment informs right effort in helping you to, as the Buddha says, generate desire to want to do the right thing. The third way in which discernment informs right effort is in learning how to discern which type of effort is appropriate for whatever's happening. There are actually four efforts. There's one, avoiding unskillful habits. The second is abandoning any unskillful habits that have already arisen. The third one is giving rise to skillful habits. And the fourth is, once their skillful habits are there, is you try to develop them as far as they can go. So the practice is not simply just one of letting go. There are actually four different ways that you can exert right effort. And there's some discernment in appreciating which is appropriate. There's a famous example from Ajahn Chah, where a storm had gone through the monastery and done quite a lot of damage. And so the next day he was walking through the monastery to check out and see how the monastery was. And there was this one hut where half the roof had blown off. And the monk was sitting in the hut, you know, meditating, but not fixing the roof. And the Ajahn Chah asked him, why aren't you fixing the roof? And the monk said, well, I'm practicing equanimity. I'm learning how to let go. And then Ajahn Chah said, this is the equanimity of a water buffalo. Fix the roof. In other words, there are things that have to be done sometimes. You don't just let go, let go, let go. Of the four efforts, the one that tends to get the least attention is the one of avoiding. In other words, when you see that there's a potential for something unskillful, you do what you can to prevent it from happening even to begin with. Now, this can involve such simple things as restraint of the senses. You know, if that you listen to a particular program, it'll get you angry. Well, don't listen. Learn how to train your mind first so that you don't get angry, then you can listen. But if you find that you're going to get angry, just don't turn on the show. Or if you're going to be meeting with someone else, you can actually use your meditation to prepare for future contingents. Meditation is not just about being in the present moment, but it's also seeing there are things that are going to come up in the future. I can use my meditation to help prevent unskillful actions on my own part. There are two ways you could do this. If you're going to be meeting with someone difficult, first, spread thoughts of goodwill to them before you go into the meeting. Or if you're feeling shy or intimidated by the person, you can hold in mind that image that I gave you this afternoon. You've got a sword in your hand. You cut off the person's head if you want to, but you're not going to because you're kind. But you still have that power. Another way you can use your meditation in preparation for difficult situations is if you know that you have someone is very good at what we English say, pushing your buttons. And so you have to figure out, how do I make sure my buttons don't get pushed? And so before you go in, sit and meditate, pose that question in your mind and then do your regular meditation. Then when you come out of meditation, give yourself 10 or 15 minutes to think about what would be the right thing to say, what would be the right thing to do, so as to avoid getting your buttons pushed. So this is one way in which you can actually use your meditation, not just to be in the present moment, but to prepare for the future, so that you can engage in the right effort of avoiding unskillful habits before they even happen. The fourth way in which discernment informs right effort is revolves around the issue of the amount of effort that is appropriate. Now, this will depend on two different things. In some cases, the amount of effort is determined by the actual issue that you're dealing with in your mind. Some issues require more energy than others. The second one is your own level of energy that you have at that particular time. In case of the first one and the issue, the Buddha basically says that there are two kinds of suffering in the mind, or two kinds of causes for suffering in the mind. Those that when you simply look at them with equanimity will go away. In other words, a thought comes up in the mind that would ordinarily push you, but when you just stop and look at it, and you realize, this is stupid, I don't need this, and the issue goes away. This is one of the reasons why bare awareness sometimes works in dealing with unskillful qualities in the mind. However, there's some issues, the Buddha says, do not go away just by looking at them. And you might say that you look at them and they look right back. They're not intimidated by you. And in this case, you have to, as the Buddha says, exert a fabrication. In other words, think of the three kinds of fabrication. What way do I breathe to get past this issue? What way do I talk to myself to get past it? What perceptions and do I hold in mind? What feelings do I try to create in my body so that I have the strength to deal with this issue? The feelings, of course, you create through the breath. We've given you some examples of how you develop goodwill using perceptions. One way of dealing with a situation where someone is being really harsh with you and you feel that you're being overwhelmed or intimidated, the Buddha says to think of your own goodwill as being as large as the earth, that no matter what, a person can come along and they can dig in the earth and they can spit on the earth and they can urinate on the earth and say, be without earth, be without earth. But still, the earth is going to stay there. It's much larger. If you can see that my goodwill, my patience is bigger than this issue, then it helps get you through the issue. The Buddha also says you can think of your mind as being like space. People can try to draw pictures in space, but there's nothing left. In the same way, people can come and say things to you with the purpose of hurting your feelings, but you can just think, oh, my mind is like space. I'm not going to let them write anything on my mind. Just let it disappear. And that way, that particular perception, that image that you hold in mind, can help you get past some difficult situations that you wouldn't be able to do otherwise. So when an issue comes up, you have to ask yourself, how much effort does this issue require? Some issues require just a little bit, some require a lot. And John Mahabua has an analogy. He says, there's some stains in the floor that all you have to do is take a little piece of cloth and wipe it and the stain goes away. There are others, you come in and there's a huge pile of excrement in the floor. It's going to require a lot of water to get rid of it. In the same way, sometimes your effort has to be very refined. Other times it requires a lot more effort based on the issue. The second area is, of course, your own level of energy. There's a famous story in the canon. There was a young monk who was very delicately brought up. In fact, he was so delicately brought up that he had hair on the bottom of his feet. And there's a story that actually goes with this. The word gets to the king. There's this young man whose feet are so tender that he has hair on the bottom of his feet. The king wants to see this. So he sends word to the parents saying, I want to see your son. And the parents take the son aside and say, there's only one reason why the king would want to see you, and that's because of the hair on your feet. So when you go in to see him, don't point your feet out, but simply sit with your feet in in a half lotus position so that the king can see, oh yes, there is hair on the bottom of his feet. At any rate, after the young man has gone to see the king says, okay, I've talked to you about issues of worldly importance. Now why don't you go listen to the Buddha? The Buddha will teach you the Dharma. The young man goes, listens to the Dharma, and decides to ordain. After he ordains, however, he is meditating so hard, he does walking meditation so much that his tender feet start to bleed. And so he gets discouraged. He says, here I'm putting all this effort in and I'm not getting anywhere in my practice. Why don't I just give up? And just at that moment, the Buddha appears in front of him. You can imagine what it's like. You're sitting here meditating and you have thoughts about giving up on the retreat and everything, all of a sudden the Buddha appears right in front of you. And so, are you thinking of giving up? And the young monk said, well, yes, I was. And so the Buddha said, back when you were still a layperson, did you play the lute? And just as a parenthetical comment, the way the Buddha asks this is, were you skilled at playing the lute? He uses the word kusala. Sometimes kusala is translated as wholesome, but here it obviously means skillful. He's not asking, did you play wholesome songs on your lute? He says, were you skilled at playing the lute? And the young man said, and the young monk says, yes. And what was it like when the lute was tied, but tuned, that the strings were too tight? Did it sound good? No. If the strings were too loose, did it sound good? No. So in other words, you have to tune them so they're just right, and then you can play. And the Buddha said in the same way, you have to tune your effort to the energy you have, and then based on that, you tune the other factors, what they call faculties of conviction, mindfulness, concentration, and discernment. And there you can pick up your meditation theme. So, depending on the level of energy that you have, sometimes you can put a lot of energy in, sometimes you can only put just a little bit. You have to learn how to read your own level of energy as to what you're capable of, so that you don't push yourself too hard, but at the same time you're not too lax on yourself. So, these are the ways in which you have to look at the amount of effort. It depends on the issue that you're dealing with, and also with your own level of strength. This is the fourth area in which discernment informs right effort. So those are the four ways in which discernment informs right effort, teaching you about the distinction between what's skillful and unskillful, in terms of your motivation, in terms of the type of effort, and in terms of the amount of effort that you're going to put in at any particular time. In the practice of right effort, however, we also gain discernment in two important ways, both of which have to do with learning how to think strategically. Remember, we're on a path that leads to a goal. And sometimes there are things on the path that you need to use that will not be part of the goal. For instance, when you're going to be practicing concentration, it requires desire. It requires, in a sense, that you actually cling to the object. And it requires a very strong, confident sense of self. Now, but ultimately, all three of these things, the desire, the clinging, and the sense of self, will have to be abandoned. But in the meantime, you learn how to use them to get the results that you need. So that's one of the first lessons that we learn from right effort. The other is simply in terms of learning how to talk yourself into doing things in a way that requires that you learn to understand your own psychology. In other words, how you motivate yourself. The Buddha said basically there are four kinds of actions in the world. There are the things that are pleasant to do and give good results, things that are unpleasant to do and give bad results. Both of those are what in English we call no-brainers. It requires no brain at all. If it's pleasant, gives good results, you'll do it easily. If it's unpleasant, gives bad results, you're not going to do it. The things that require discernment are the things that are pleasant to do but give bad results in the long term, and the things that are unpleasant to do but give good results in the long term. And the Buddha said this is a measure of your wisdom, your ability to talk yourself into doing the things that you don't like to do, but will give good results, and your ability to talk yourself out of doing things that you like to do but will give bad results. Sometimes we think that Buddhist wisdom is all about abstractions like emptiness and dependent co-arising and interconnectedness, but the Buddha basically said this is the measure of your wisdom, something very practical like this. Can you talk yourself into doing things that are in your own best interest even though you don't like doing them? Can you talk yourself out of doing things that are not in your interest, but you like doing them? And this way, that this is really how your discernment is going to be measured, because this applies not only on outside matters, but also on things deep inside the mind. So, right effort, as I said earlier, is not brute effort. It's an effort that is informed by discernment and also gives rise to more discernment that you're going to be able to use in your practice of right mindfulness, the practice of right concentration.